Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this lecture. My name's John Denton. I'm an architect around town. A first note, could everyone please note that this is being filmed and audio recorded, and we really need to make sure that everybody does have their mobile phones either turned to silent or turned off. The thread of today's session in the Festival of Ideas has been climate change in Australia, trauma or transformation. And so tonight we have a keynote lecture from Professor Tom Kavan, and the title of his talk is The Responsible City, Urban Change in a Time of Climate Change. Tom is the Dean of Architecture at Building and Planning here at Melbourne University, having come from years in a similar role at Hong Kong University and at Sydney University. He's widely experienced in the professional world as well as academia. I understand his CV is in the program, so I won't go on, but I would note that he is currently just finishing a book with Justyna Karakowicz that is coming out soon on urban evolution called The Making of Hong Kong, a place that he knows intimately well. C.A. Doxiadis in the 1960s created terms such as megalopolis and ecumenopolis to anticipate the city-states that we now see emerging. William Gibson, in his book Neuromancer in the 80s, describes cities that no longer have any imageable form or definable boundary. And more recently, from films like Ridley Scott, like Blade Runner or other books of Gibson, we get offered metropolises of light and dark, of high energy or vital urbanism, complex organisms never entirely comfortable, always a place with dark corners and suffering. Cities of the future, grubby, dripping steam, messy and criminal rather than orderly and sustainable. Is this really the future? It's hard to come to grips with the way the modern city functions and to be able to form as multi-layered a view of the city as that which cinema or new science fiction's been able to offer. But come to grips with it, we must. Cities must become part of the solution to the world's environmental problems. Housing half the world's population, but using three-quarters of its resources and generating three-quarters of its pollution, there is no choice but to make cities more sustainable. So tonight, Tom will discuss the role of cities in this climate change debate, but he'll discuss it from a morphological point of view, the need for increased intensity of resource use, which will also require cultural response. Tom.
Good evening. This is quite a challenge to try and deal with the topic of a city in a matter of an hour, but I'll give it a good bash. Let's try. What is a city? I put here an image of one you're familiar with. More importantly, what is a great city? This is a city that gets regularly voted into being a great city. But then what does it mean for us to think of a great and sustainable city? Hold that in your mind. In his recent book, Commonwealth, Jeffrey Sachs called this the urban century. He notes that we have started this century with more people living in what he calls urban centers rather than villages, denoting a shift from a focus on agricultural production to urban consumption of these products and to engage in other activities such as manufacturing and services. Predictions from the United Nations suggest that all of the 1.7 billion increase in global population in the next 20 years will take place in urban contexts. This change is occurring everywhere across the globe, and we here in Melbourne are not isolated from this change as we plan for a city of 5 million. China is in the midst of moving 450 million people from the countryside to the cities to provide them with employment, higher standards of health, and living. The pressure on cities is worldwide. We need to think closely about the city, the suburbs, and their roles in our future. While the goals of past planners guiding these developments is not to be belittled or dismissed, times have changed, and we now have both knowledge previously unknown and challenges anew. Of course, this urban focus is not the future here. It's well known that in the 1911 census of Australia, only 42% of the population lived in areas defined as rural. Already at the start of the 20th century, Australia was known as a largely urban place, although it quickly became suburban, and today it's estimated that over 70% of the population lives in suburbs. In this talk, I'll review some of the issues at hand, identify four challenges for those who fashion the future of cities, and review one proposition as a test. In these, I'll limit myself not to Melbourne alone or Australia, as I claim no expertise here, but only I'll speak of the Asia-Pacific region more broadly, and of solutions and issues that are not just local. If we are indeed destined to an urban future, and we seek to develop livable cities, then we have some careful thinking ahead of us and some careful choices. The theme of this festival of ideas is climate change, cultural change, and it's in this perspective I framed my remarks this evening. In the context of climate change, we should recognize that cities are a major contributor of CO2 output, and it's from this perspective I'll address the question. I recognize there's debate on the impact of cities and carbon emission, and that the capacity of cities to affect the future, but the debate is about the degrees of effect, not the fact that cities are positioned in a critically influential position in the carbon cycle. John's just given you some statistics. Every time you look up the statistics, you get slightly different numbers, but mine roughly agree with his. By one estimate, cities consume about 75% of the world's energy and are responsible for 80% of the greenhouse gas emissions. As the Clinton Climate Initiative of C40 cities, of which Melbourne City Council is an active member, notes, cities bear a large responsibility for causing climate change and are therefore key to alleviating climate change. We have to move from a high energy use, wasteful economic model to one that conserves energy and minimizes waste. In other words, we have to be more efficient. I think that understates the case. Cities consume energy, and city dwellers benefit from this. Energy is used to make our lives comfortable, ensure we have food to eat, facilitates our movement, ensures we are kept entertained, and helps us reach our goals. Large and intensive places, cities and their users visibly turn energy into light, but they clog the streets with cars, they generate waste, they create pollution, and create problems. So, why not just reduce the population in cities and spread them out? Well, if we're trying to address the core drivers of climate change, most notably the generation of greenhouse gases, cities deserve a very close examination. And to prepare you for this, I'm going to give you a potted history of cities, if I may. If we look at this, at the locations of the largest cities in the world at intervals throughout human history, we see how the regions in which they are present shifts from the early crucibles of civilization across areas we call now the Middle East and China in the year 100 AD. Spreading slightly more in the year 1000. Notice that the population of the larger cities is annotated at the bottom of the slide. In the 900-year interval, the largest city is still under 500,000 people. As we move on, the distribution of these larger cities is not changing substantially by the year 1500, nor the population of the largest. In the year 1800, the largest city has gained in population, and you may notice that European cities have now started to appear on this list. But don't top it. In the interval to the beginning of the 20th century, however, you notice a very substantial change. At this point, the majority of the largest cities have appeared in Europe and Americas, and the population of the largest, London, has attained a size substantially larger than ever reached before. By the time we get to 1950, the largest cities are barely present in the area where the largest cities previously were for the first 1,500 years. Bringing us up to date, there's some UN data here that shows us where the largest cities are expected. And you notice that they are no longer in Europe. The red and yellow dots are the cities that should appear in 2000 to 2015, and they're all in the region in which we sit. What brings about this shift? When the largest cities came to be found in Europe. Without much difficulty, you can identify that it's industrialization. In bringing people together into places of production, initially factories, but later offices, industrialized countries benefited from the efficiencies of co-location and production. This change occurs rapidly in 200 years in which the West drove the transition from agriculture to industry, riding on the back of scientific farming and mechanization. Cities are a social construct, and their forms are manifestations of collective aspirations. As the Industrial Revolution unfolded, cities gained rapidly in population as the generation of wealth gained momentum. Indeed, cities played the same role today as substantial generators of wealth. As a consequence of this change of production and consequence wealth, however, cities changed their roles, and most importantly, their nature. At this point, we can observe the city ceased to be the locus of life and work, and instead came to be a seat as a place from which to escape the workday. As Graham Davison has written, some beliefs current in the mid-19th century drove this change of perception. And to quote, "The idea of the villa suburb reflected the influence of four great contemporary ideas," this is in the middle of the 19th century, evangelicalism, sanitarianism, romanticism, and class segregation. Evangelicalism reinforced the idea of the family as the focus of religious and moral life, and the suburban home as a sanctuary from the venality and vice of the city. Sanitarianism, the new science of public health, saw the suburb as a safe haven from the dirt and disease of the city's overcrowded streets and courts and alleys. Romanticism emphasized the idea of the suburban home, especially the suburban garden, as a place where people might seek refuge from the artificiality and noise of the city amidst the quiet and beauty of nature. And in a society where class distinctions were becoming sharply defined, the suburb as a zone of exclusive middle-class residents offered new ways of symbolizing and reinforcing them. Why were these beliefs so powerful? I assume it's because of the dreadful reality of the cities of their time. By the mid-19th century, Britain was a leading nation in industrialization, faced the significant problem of inner city degradation. Health and the quality of life were poor. At this point, two key ideas emerged that will affect the development of cities around the world to the extent that we know them today. One idea sought to address the quality of life, and the second enabled its implementation. I'll not address the chronology of their appearance, but two came together over a brief period and came to characterize the subsequent phase of development. The first notion is that the elements of a productive city could be separated into its productive parts, and that these could be sited in such a way that the problems of pollution and health could be mitigated. Ebenezer Howard, a social reformist, developed a powerful idea that caught the imagination of many by its elegance and clarity. Here you see in Howard's graceful images the idea that of the Elysian existence, very much current in English as a imagery at the time, could be found by arranging factories, farms, and homes in geometric purity in a circle and taking into consideration wind directions to ensure that the pollution from the factories didn't bother local residents. While there were many proposals for utopian or ideal towns generated at the time, it was Howard's that resonated and found favor, and in it are the seeds of how we live today. If Howard had found a formal solution, how could it be built? Cities were cash-strapped, having to invest very substantially in infrastructures to address the population, the problems of safe water supply and sewerage. Ways had to be found to reduce the population of cities, which meant moving people in and out of the city on a daily basis. And the answer lay in the market. The train companies in England were sold the license to lay tracks, but they needed to ensure they had customers. So to this end, they were given the rights to develop substantial tracts of land at points along the railway to and from which people would need to travel. To this end, the concept of such living had to be the message of a particular lifestyle, not unlike the marketing we see today. The commuter was created, fashioned from the combination of the idea of living outside the city was better for your health, and then the need to access the workplace. I might note here that Howard's idea of the garden city with a density of 79 persons per hectare was received in Australia as a strategy for densification, given the generous spread of Australian suburbs by this time. Even now, Melbourne's density in 1996 was 13.6 persons per hectare against Howard's 79. Although this is more than double that in the city centres was is below Howard's model. After several decades, we can observe that the outcome is not quite what Howard imagined. While suburbs play an important role in some nations, especially here in Australia, they have some unanticipated side consequences, side effects. The imagery of cities and our aspirations for where we live and work are fashioned by a number of influences and vested interests. Not too far from the four mid-19th century ideas that Davison described, the image of the middle of the 20th century was by now the nuclear family ensconced on their plot of land, ringed by a white picket fence in North America, or graced by a hill's hoist in Australia. Garden cities, however, were not designed with cars in mind, but on the assumption that residents would walk, bicycle, or ride the train to various destinations. That this model has been given over to the car, with its particular ability to dominate the landscape, is a very unfortunate turn of events. Even in 1954, Melbourne's Metropolitan Planning Scheme identified that the sprawl had created such problems in traffic that consolidation had to be addressed. And yet, somehow, it dodged the issue. Other models have been postulated, such as that developed by Charles Edward Jeanneret, who's more commonly known as Le Corbusier. Desiring to ensure a bright and healthy environment in the city, he developed a model of the city called the Radiant City, the Ville Radieuse. From these models, housing towers surrounded by gardens were erected worldwide. Often, they did not lead to great success. And they've left a dreadful legacy in which density is mistakenly associated with towers and poverty. It's with this corruption of the habitable city models that we focus on a key issue when we examine the question of the contribution of the city to climate change. Recognizing that in Australia, it's been argued that the national identity is closely tied to the suburban and low-density living, where there are many benefits of the model appreciated, we cannot avoid the question of whether this can be continued and whether it can be propagated as a model in emerging and expanding cities around the region to accommodate the 1.7 billion that we're going to increase. Although cities use a substantial portion of the energy consumed in the world, the contribution of the inner city to carbon emissions is proportionally less than those who live in suburbs and rural areas. A recent report from the Brookings Institution identified that the carbon footprints of metro area residents in the United States of America are 14% smaller than the average Americans. If we are to address our carbon footprints, one strategy clearly is to increase the proportion of people living in such more energy efficient communities and aggregations of people, the ones we call cities. What does it then makes the difference between the carbon emissions of inner city dwellers and outer urban dwellers? One is the size of the dwelling. Establishing a house on a virgin plot allows the homeowner to accommodate all of their aspirations, aspirations fed by a consumer culture, bringing in with it the large television screen, the individual spaces for each function, regardless of how frequently it's used. The statistics bear a rather scaring tale. The average size of a house in Australia is now over 200 square metres, about twice the size they were in 1950. Australia is not alone in this, of course. We can observe the same trend in much of the world. It appears in this context across the world that we have a capacity to dream large. Yet, beyond the size of houses, it's the manner in which they are configured as a community that has a substantial impact. Urban morphologies, that is, the shape and form of a city, can be correlated to energy use and carbon production, both in construction and in use. Here, we see the profound impact of government underwritten strategies to develop particular modes of transport to the disadvantage of others. While construction methods and building form have some impact, the major contributor to the difference in carbon footprints of urban development lies in transportation. Per passenger kilometer, the car produces twice the greenhouse gas emissions of trains. There's recent US data on total energy consumption, which aligns with these earlier data from Newman and Kenworthy in 1999, which is a very famous graph, which is why I use this one, in which the correlation between urban density, which is the axis across the bottom, and energy used in transport, the axis, the y-axis, can be identified. The denser the city, the less you use in urban transport and transportation energy. And the data align astonishingly clearly. With current conditions of road infrastructures, Australia is wasting over $3 billion per year in immobile traffic. There are, of course, consequential dangers arriving from the reliance on cars. Those riding in cars, for example, exposed to significantly higher pollution levels than those who walk or bicycle. The resultant lack of exercise, too, is a much discussed problem, as this leads, of course, to national obesity. It's not just cars, however, that consume the energy. The high energy demand for transportation in sprawling cities mirrors the consumption of electricity. And this chart here shows the electricity consumption in US cities, again, density of cities across the bottom, and consumption in the vertical axis. The basic conclusion is that the more intensely developed cities have a lower carbon footprint than less intensely developed ones. Greenhouse gas emissions from transport in Victoria represent 16% of the state's total, but emissions from cars represent 62% of that 16. While these may be the data on a collective urban scale, there's some work recently being written up that looks at the impact of building form, construction, efficiency, and transport choices that breaks it down into the detail. Bob Fuller of Deakin University and Robert Crawford here at the University of Melbourne have recently documented this according to different building forms. And their findings are currently under review, but they very kindly allowed me to show you some of their results ahead of the publication. Developing on an earlier paper by Fuller and Treloar in 2004, which quantified greenhouse gas emissions by housing type, size, construction, and location, this more recent paper brings in residential energy use, namely water heating, cooking, and other appliance use, and the results are presented in per capita use. Expanding on this then, Fuller and Crawford have compared four prototypical residential units across Melbourne. The suburban house, typical to those built in 2008 in greenfield sites around Melbourne. The second is a 7-star rated suburban house built in the same location. The 7-star refers to the star rating for energy efficiency, and 7 stars is exceedingly energy efficient by the rating. An inner suburban medium density energy efficient apartment, such as exemplified here by the K2 apartments, and then inner city high-rise, exemplified by Docklands. So for each of these, they calculated, first, the embodied energy. Embodied energy is the energy used to manufacture materials for the house and construct it. The second was operating energy, and the third, energy for travel, based upon the location of the house. And assuming that the source of employment was largely the CBD. So their findings are stark and clear. The base comparator is the 2008 house. While we may aspire to use more efficient construction processes, such as highly efficient detailing, in order to attain the 7-star rating, the suburban house, even at 7 stars, cannot approach the efficiencies of inner city housing. The 7-star rating was found to be a mere 9%, hardly earning it 7 stars. Taking in especially into consideration the substantial energy for commuting. By comparison, the inner city and suburban, and city building forms were substantially more energy efficient. The slightly higher embodied energy and operating energy requirements in the high rise for elevators and the likes make it slightly less efficient than the K2 version of the lower rise outer city, but the locations of these buildings is not specific to their performance necessarily, except in terms of the land they consume, the number of people who can occupy a hectare, and therefore the transportation outcomes. Thus, The advances in technologies of materials construction may make some headway in reducing carbon output, but not much in the overall picture. Where the US study mentioned earlier found that the carbon footprints of metro area residents were 14% smaller than the suburban, this study suggests that any additional residents we take up in the city of Melbourne can reduce their carbon footprints by up to 50% by the choice of where they live. The broader costs of a particular urban morphology are not only in the use of energy and the production of CO2. The recent bushfires remind us of this, of the displacement of people from the city because of their difficulty of access to reasonable housing and employment. As George Megalongenis asked in The Australian on the weekend after Black Saturday, can we afford to treat the bush as a postcode for affordable living? As he noted, we've made this abrogation of responsibility to address the urban attractiveness by glorifying it as a population shift for tree change instead. Instead, the statistics show that the population living in the bush is heavily mortgaged with larger families and lower levels of education and commensurately lower income, since employment is largely in the lower paid manual range out there. They have less access to education, less access to employment. As he observed, the bush hides the fact that significant parts of it have more people in common with concrete housing estates than the pastoral idyll. These people are living there because they cannot afford to live in the city. And therefore, they're trapped in this low income and low opportunity future. In doing so, they've also trapped themselves in the high operating cost future, making it even harder to move out of that. Essentially, the city has let them down. So, what we have now, unfortunately, is a situation in which the several benefits that might accrue from accessing a city are now out of reach of many who live in suburbs, as they never get a chance to access the city. Unfortunately, we've created cities that exclude many. For many reasons, not only for the safety from forces of nature, we need to create cities that are inclusive. But what these data have shown, and what is clear that we cannot wait upon technology and sciences to address the problem for us. We need to conceive of alternatives and develop opportunities in urban life. It's particularly important here to remind ourselves that we cannot rely on ideas developed 1.5 centuries ago in response to an industrialization in Europe and North America. Their models were conceived to address problems of a different scale. Howard's garden cities were intended to accommodate 50,000 people. Our problems in the Asian region are different, both in scale, in demographic content, in cultural and social context. We are significantly removed from 19th century Britain. Let me digress here, if I may, just for a moment, to dwell on the possible contribution of design to this question. As Dean of the Faculty of Architecture, Building and Planning, I have a vested interest to try and explore this particular issue. But through design, I want to postulate a future. Obviously, design is an essential activity in creating the responsive city. But in what way is this the case? Well, allow me to look at the process of design and to show you why it's an important aspect of this debate. You may have noticed, I hope you did, that recently we launched a graduate school in the Faculty of Architecture, Building and Planning, and we called it the Melbourne School of Design. It's an intentional act, of course, one not taken casually. The school delivers a range of master's programs and research programs, including architecture, urban design, landscape architecture, programs you might normally associate with design. But in our case, we also offer urban planning, construction, and property. We conceive of design as encompassing the full range of deliberative conceptual acts from planning and policy through to construction and operation of buildings. All of these are design acts for us. They are design in that they have the capacity to embrace conceptual and synthetic engagement with the potential of what our habitable future is. And they're all essential to that. We could approach these as strictly production-focused tasks, the application of bodies of separate bodies of skills to delineated actions. This is inadequate for the challenges that we have for these disciplines, for they will require us to engage in the most inventive ways. The manner in which we conceive of ownership rights in the future city, for example, will either constrain us to modes that favor freestanding houses on greenfield sites, or they might enable us to envision ways that we can live in different forms, or these different modes might free us to envision legitimate identity for new forms of residential buildings. Similarly, the approaches to zoning-based planning will limit us to two-dimensional polygons and constructed our lives constructed around segregated activities, unless we conceive of planning in a different way. All of these professional engagements will demand the most creative thinking if we aspire to a different future. And that is design. Design is this different way of thinking. It's a capacity to postulate a previously unarticulated opportunity and to identify a means by which to realize this unknown. That the opportunity may take on unfamiliar forms or manifest unexpected properties is possible, but not necessarily a condition of design. Cities and their forms are cultural constructs, not ordained. They are ones of our choice. We need to find ways in which we can conceive of and realize places where families can achieve their dreams. If we are to make the difference, it's a change in culture and a perception that's needed. If you wish to see a little manifestation of this, we have an exhibition right now in the faculty of student work called Liquid Futures, which examines the city and water and what the implications are of the future of the former city in the absence of water. Having digressed just for a moment to illuminate you about my perception of design, now, and that's design as a mechanism by which to explore the future, now I want to return to the main theme, the potential for a responsive city. Bringing you back to my earlier comments, let me remind you that cities are not evil. While they are not only in the manner in which we can live in aggregation, there is much that commends them as preferable forms to accommodating substantial numbers of people who are leaving areas of rural China or who are migrating to Melbourne. It's these increments we need to consider, not the status quo. The integration of residences and work opportunities were the essence of earlier cities. Before we segregated the two and instituted commuting as a norm. To return to this, I then ask, why do people not wish to live in inner cities, especially in Australia and the United States? Cities have their positive attributes. They have been an essential element in the development of civilizations. They are crucibles of technological, cultural, and social innovation. These have come about for a number of reasons, from pragmatic ones such as cost. It's cheaper to move around a city, and you can reach more people and more activities in a shorter distance. This measure, you can say, is a measure of intensity. Thus, an attribute is that cities can be and need to be more intense. And here, I just want to differentiate a statement from more common phrasing, that cities are more dense. Density has a connotation that immediately brings about assumptions of built form that have been found to be wanting, precluding from any discussion, therefore, the merits of other forms of urban city. Density does not correlate to intensity. You can have highly dense places which are dead. Take any dormitory town. And you can have highly intense places that are not dense. I'm going to show you for a moment an approach that I've undertaken very briefly. There are attributes of a city that make it compelling, and on several of these which I'd like to focus. Let me then illustrate this by way of a design undertaken at the behest of a railway company, by chance, reflecting what I set the scene earlier with the poster from Golders Green and the Underground in London. This was work I did with a team in Hong Kong at the request of the Kowloon Canton Railway Company, the KCRC as it's known, which is the heavy rail company in Hong Kong. They were required to build a rail station in a greenfield site in the Northern New Territories and were given the rights to develop a town on that site in order to develop the riders for the train, exactly paralleling what happened in London, in Golders Green and elsewhere. So in order to develop ridership for a train station, they needed 200,000 people in this town. Here we are zoomed in, showing you what 800 meters looks like on a valley. They had to live, 200,000 people had to live within 800 meters of the railway station, because that allowed them to walk to the railway station. If they live beyond 800 meters, an alternative form of transport is needed, and they may stick to that form of transport rather than using the train. In other words, they could jump in a car and drive, and we're trying to avoid that. So, before I take you through the strategy we used and the outcome, let me note that the project came to a very shuddering halt when the KCRC was then purchased and merged into the Underground Railway Company, the MTRC, or the MTR. The success of the MTR as a company was derived from their right to develop and hold land above their stations, thus realizing the capital benefit of installing a railway and using that capital to construct the railway. Exactly the same model that was used in London at the end of the 19th century. The typical mode of their developments, however, are this: the podium and the tower, and a form in which many of the aspirations of the occupants fails to be met. This talk is called The Responsive City, and by this I'm conjuring up an image of a city that engages its inhabitants to address climate change. In this proposal that we did for KCRC, we addressed the site in a culturally and locationally specific manner, following principles that may have been said to be indicative of a responsive city. Let me start by giving you a little bit of analysis of geometry and the capacity to accommodate people, which is well known in the area of urban design, but if that's not your field, you may not have seen this slide. It comes from work by Leslie Martin and Lionel March in the early 1960s in Britain. And they used the courtyards of Cambridge as an inspiration, where they were both teaching at the time. They noted that the tower and the low-rise building and the low-rise courtyard all contain the same number of people in this image. And yet, the effect is distinctly different. So, that's, as I said, a very well-known image. One of the other images we were working with was the intensity of Hong Kong and the power of place in Hong Kong. This is illustrated here in a drawing of Mong Kok, one of the areas that's quite popular in Hong Kong. We developed a city of 200,000 people from using 6 to 12-story buildings only, no podium and tower required, all within an area of an 800-meter radius. And this was attaining a population density that's substantially lower in spot density than much of Hong Kong. Using a computer representation technique called parametric modeling, the courtyard units were then arranged in the valley and distorted to allow for wind flow, sun angle, and access, giving you an outline of a city that might look like this. Each city block was then dissected into its component parts. We needed to accommodate gardens throughout the city. There are gardens on the roof, in the middle, and on the ground, as well as street access and vehicle access. We needed then to angle the buildings to get better sun angle to capture the sun. And so that was done parametrically, and the building shapes changed. And these then were aggregated together to form the city of 200,000 people, and it was broken down into component parts and analyzed for its financial viability. And it was demonstrated that financially it is viable. By taking this series of steps, we then demonstrated we could create opportunities to integrate agriculture at small scales, communal farms, communal gardens, sporting facilities, outdoor exercise areas and opportunities throughout the buildings. In fact, this plan comes up with a series of hiking paths that come down off the hills of Hong Kong and up over the buildings and then down onto the hills next door. So you walk over the hills of Hong Kong, including the city. This was a volumetric city. Now, while you can dismiss this, let me show you something else. You may have seen it as conjectural only and specific to Hong Kong, but I don't know if you noticed that on Sunday, this past Sunday, in New York, they just opened this park called the High Line Park. It is built on an old railway line that runs through Lower Manhattan, and it is now an outdoor space that sits at the higher level of about 7 stories, stretching its way through the city. These examples show you cities that rely on short distances. They focus on health, they use green infrastructure, they exemplify and demonstrate equity, and most importantly, in a volumetric sense, they become productive. They generate land instead of consuming land, and they generate activity, and they could even generate food. And those principles are the ones, I think, which underlie a responsive city. So the project I've just demonstrated, it doesn't just address the 3 dimensions of sustainability. I think it addresses a 4th dimension, which is never mentioned, which is the issue of time. We don't want sustainability now. We want sustainability for a period into the future. To capture the intent of this, we coined a phrase while doing that project, and we called it naturbia rather than suburbia. The movement to cities across the world is an outcome of the role that cities have played in all time. They are places of opportunity. This has led to cities as the incubator of middle class. As more people move into the city, the middle class increases in number, in purchasing power, in political voice, and in this, there are some implications of the demographic shifts that we're seeing. 1.7 million, a billion people are moving to cities. That's a substantial increase to the middle class potential. If 450 million are moving in China to cities, there's some profound implications for China and profound implications for us all. As Marx noted, when reflecting on the shift of balance in population in Europe in the 19th century from rural to urban, he said, "The bourgeoisie has played a most revolutionary part in history. Playing this out across the region, including those extra millions expected to join us in Melbourne, cities are a powerful place of political and social change. The middle class behave differently. They are concerned less with survival and more with the future of their children, more engaged with abstract values than traditional mores." The American sociologist David Reisman has suggested that the middle class mind, this is a famous reference some of you might be familiar with, the middle class mind works as a radar, not like a gyroscope. He describes it as taking in information across the social landscape rather than spinning on one point. The middle classes are interested in improving the lot not only of themselves, but for their grandchildren. With this growth in the middle class and the concerns of the future, we have a very substantial social mass in its making if we look at cities and their change. If their aspirations are thwarted, they can become a significant source of social and political instability. Look at what's happening in Tehran in the last 48 hours. With quality of life on their agenda and their concentration in cities, it's clear that the question of quality of urban life must take a priority as a domestic and also, I think, a foreign policy agenda item. The unhealthy and unsustainable sprawl of cities comes about through financial purpose, cultural myopia, and legislative laziness, I think. The design and form of cities is no longer a matter to be left to economic drivers and developer comfort. As Jeffrey Sachs notes in Commonwealth, as indeed others have commented, we need an approach to the future of the city as an issue of urban ecology, in which humans are part of a healthy ecological system, and that this future is one that demands, says Jeffrey Sachs, a scientific and policy approach. To this, I would add very strongly, the issues are also cultural and aesthetic. The approach will only be found if we engage in new and unaccustomed ways of thinking. It's salutary for me to read that in Sachs's opinion, the failure of urban form in the last 2 centuries has derived in part from the fact that those who have the capacity to guide and influence the outcomes, the architects, urban planners, ecologists, public health specialists, and environmental engineers, have failed to work together, to share a language, and to share priorities. As he notes, the impact of the future of future failure will rest disproportionately on the developing world. We in Australia should take note of this. It is our neighbours who are and will feel this burden. It's not about us alone. As Melbourne takes in more population, many of these people will be departing the problems of their current regions and coming and looking for an alternative. This is where the University of Melbourne can make an impact, by beginning the process of acculturating the many participants of the process together. It is this that we are beginning to address with our groundbreaking undergraduate curriculum in the Bachelor of Environments, and which we continue in our graduate schools. It's not a matter of championing one solution as a model for the region, or pursuing one ideology against another. Here at the University of Melbourne, we welcome students and staff throughout the world, and we address questions of importance beyond our shores as well as locally. I recognize that debate in Melbourne is different to that in Shanghai or in Jakarta, and it's from across all of these that we must be active. But in taking a lead again from SACS, major research universities have a unique role in tackling problems free from political and commercial interference. As he notes, we're not traditionally good at this, however. We're not good at organizing ourselves around major transdisciplinary questions, and the question of the city is clearly one of these. I mentioned earlier in the potted history of cities that there are two powerful ideas that emerge at the beginning of the end of the 19th century, that brought momentum to the form of the city: how we live and how we finance it. We're at the moment where we need to address these again. We need to imagine what cities can be, and then we need to find ways to finance the realization. Effective as they were 100 years ago or more, neither of the earlier answers can be the right one for today. A century ago, a generation dreamt of an alternative future, and they worked to realize it. This is our opportunity, our obligation, to dream again and to realize. Here in Melbourne, I think we have the capacity and the leadership in the city, the universities, and the community. The future of cities is a matter of greatest urgency, and one that we cannot approach with a cultural complacency, nor a myopia. So in closing, I'm going to pose four questions. Can we envision a city in which the aspirations of a lifestyle engaged with the outdoors, catering to the full range of family activities for all age groups, can be reconciled with our desperate need for substantially reduced carbon footprint? Are the suburbs consigned, at best, to be the commutable sin of the 20th century, or have they an urban future? Can we conceive of cities that are productive and responsive rather than consuming and static? And lastly, essentially, what modes of transport underpin these cities? As I claimed earlier, cities are social constructs. We cannot continue with a mid-19th century model, nor can we achieve this with mid-19th century attitudes among the professions that contribute. I mentioned earlier, that's the end. My apologies.
I think, as you all will have realised, Tom's suffering rather badly from a cold and from travel, and therefore we can take some questions, but only a couple, perhaps. It does bring to mind, to me, when I listen to Tom tonight, Melbourne 2030, and Melbourne and its attempts at densification rather than intensification, and I think that's a very interesting idea that I think a lot of the resistance to intensification is a reaction against bad densification, and I think it's a major issue that we have to learn about, which is how to increase the density of our inner suburbs without losing the sort of qualitative aspects that we regard as good. And I think the Hong Kong examples are really fascinating in the way they compare and show how really intense
really dense cities can in fact operate. So if people have questions, the process will go on tomorrow and there's more things happening tomorrow, but if people have questions that they desperately need to ask tonight, we can just take a few. So.
Stephen Chu, the advisor to Obama, suggested all the rooms. Stephen Chu, the advisor to Obama, suggested roofs on buildings should all be white, or reflective at least. I note everywhere around Victoria and interstate, we've got this brain-dead, dark roofs everywhere, which absorb heat and hence create global warming. Your comment on that, please.
Thank you. The suggestion that roofs be white is based on the principle that we need to try and reflect a lot of the heat, as clouds do. And as the climate change has evolved, as I understand it, there are fewer clouds and therefore there's less reflection and there's more heat absorption, which is then causing diurnal problems and heat retention. So the white roof reaction is one way of addressing that. I believe that it's probably short-sighted because it goes back to a very scientific approach. And of course, he is a scientist from the Livermore Laboratories. Scientists, the way science works is to try and isolate the problem, deal with the problem, and find a solution to it. The design approach is to try and integrate a number of opportunities. And I think there are more important problems than reflecting the sunlight. It's using it. And we can use it to cool the world by using plants. And therefore, I would advocate that we use roofs not to paint them white, but for other activities, which include nature and plants, which we can have in terms of communal gardens, sports fields, outdoor spaces, and to take a more integrated approach to that. So I'm not here to support white paint.
Yes, if I can do a little comparison. Germany has a population that is four times that of Australia, about 85 million people versus 21 million people. And yet in Germany, in an area about the size of New South Wales, the largest city is Berlin, about 3.5 million people. I think Hamburg and Munich are about 2.5 million people. But many of your German cities are not bigger than 500,000. Cologne and Stuttgart and others. And yet here in Australia, Sydney is now well over 4 million. Melbourne is approaching 4 million. And I understand that Brisbane is about 2.5 million people, perhaps even more. And yet we have this country that's very, very large, almost as big as the 48 US states. So can we learn something from Germany? Because Germany, in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, has about half of what Australia and the United States have.
Thank you. Those are very compelling statistics. There are some very clear alternatives played out across the world, and Germany is one of those, where the forms of cities can be demonstrated in alternative sizes, but to the same principles. Within Australia, there's a debate about multinodal cities or polycentric cities. There's a number of different ways of referring to these. And I believe that the polycentric city debate is in a way parallel to what you've illustrated with the German statistics. One could almost use Germany as a model of a multinodal or polycentric city-state. It is so well covered by a series of small cities, each connected with high-speed rail to facilitate easy connection between them. So there is indeed something that can be learned from that. And I think the recent plan for Sydney, and indeed some recent discussions for Melbourne, point in that direction, to try and build up a series of nodes rather than a singular node. It is a particular problem of Melbourne that it is a singularly radial city. Everything comes into one center and extends out, and that's why we have the commuting problems. So yes, there are lessons that can be learned. But behind Germany's carbon footprint, or the small size of their carbon footprint, are many other policies. They are the highest adopters of solar cells and energy production. And if you go around Germany today, you'll find that farmers have turned their fields over to solar cell growing rather than corn growing. In other words, they build solar cells to cover fields because the generation of electricity generates more income for the farmer than selling wheat or corn or anything else. That solar cell technology, by the way, was developed here in Australia.
I just had a question sort of at the level of the fact that what you're proposing is change, and change never comes about without breaking down power blocks and some people inevitably losing out because they control those power blocks. I was just wondering if you could discuss that, particularly in the Melbourne context.
Here, at this point, I will use my ignorance of Melbourne as a foil. I have been here but 2 years, and I cannot claim an expertise in the city and the power blocks that exist, although the front page of the newspaper reminds me of some of them. It is absolutely true that the configuration of a city is a manifestation of a series of influences, as I said earlier in the talk. They are manifestations of our collective aspirations. They are also manifestations of the sources of power and influence. The form of Los Angeles was profoundly influenced by General Motors and General Tire when they ripped up the tram lines and light rail system, which they managed to do by dominating the board of those companies with members of their executive. And they dismantled the city and reformed it around the car. In Melbourne, I'm led to believe that the Water Board and others have had similar profound influences over the form of Melbourne. It's inevitable. However, I think it is a matter of us raising a collective voice of sufficient clarity and power about where we want to go that changes a culture. We are going to absorb another million or 1.5 million people here. Where are we going to put them? In the current trend, we are going to put them largely on the fringe of what the current city is. We cannot afford that. So we need to have some collective voice and start building the discussion towards that change. And in that way, engage with the power sources and create other power sources.
Another cell of business here.
Just wondering how economically feasible it is to put the urban train lines underground and reclaim that land for both medium density housing and revegetation.
The question of economic feasibility is a key one. And that's why I said there are two things we needed to do. One was to conceive of the idea, and the other one was to figure out how to finance it. And you're absolutely right to ask that question. There are different ways of addressing that, however. If you simply tot up the cost and say, someone write me a check, clearly we're not going to do it. However, if you can tot up the costs and then identify the benefits that might flow from such changes, you can capture those costs. One model has been the railway company model that I illustrated both in London in the end of the 19th century and in Hong Kong at the end of the 20th century. That may be a way we could work here. I don't know. I'm not an economist, unfortunately. That's why I said we need the other professions to feed into this. But absolutely clearly, we need to find a way of facilitating the change. There are profound ways we can do it, however. Look at the amount of money that the federal government has injected into construction in the last 12 months. They've injected that into a large number of areas, schools, hospitals, roads. Those are all written with performance characteristics which align to our future, we could have already taken a large step towards that future because the funding is there for those things. However, there's no one single source. We're going to have to be quite inventive about this, but it's probably the biggest hurdle. But it can be done, I believe, once we get a cultural change behind it.
Perhaps one last question.
Yeah, I think the German exercise is something we need to look at, but it's also very important to look at Melbourne as a metropolis around Port Phillip, not in the Melbourne statistical district that we look at the moment, which doesn't have Geelong in it. And you get 63,000 vehicles a day go to Geelong. And also the link to Ballarat and Bendigo
The other real issue about Australia is that Melbourne is an inland city that's fundamentally servicing continental Australia. Now, those issues are fundamentally important about how it's going to develop. And in fact, Melbourne is going to service Sydney within the next 15 years in terms of export-import systems. And we need to get away from our view that we're looking just at the trees in the street. We've got to look at our place on the continent of Australia, where already Melbourne has a hinterland of four states, but it's got a national perspective that's growing all the time.
Thank you. That's absolutely right, and it's a very useful reminder. The cities don't exist by themselves. They exist for larger purposes and in larger contexts. What you've raised there is the need to address overall infrastructures and allow cities to form themselves around these infrastructures and to support those infrastructures. We have done exactly that. The infrastructure we've got is a road one, and therefore the city forms itself around roads and the assumptions of roads. That's where the core change has to come about. And if we are going to see a future in which Melbourne is a substantial hub of infrastructure for the whole country, as you're laying out, I think the form of that infrastructure is going to have profound influence on how we see and perceive Melbourne in the future. But obviously, Geelong is part of the polycentric opportunity for Melbourne, as are other new centres we could create connected by efficient transportation systems. A high-speed rail system between here and Geelong would make a profound difference to that.
I think we might give Tom's voice a rest at this stage. I think he's done masterly to sort of last through it all. Tom, that was a fascinating review of things that we all know to some extent, but not with the thoroughness that has been covered tonight. And I think the Hong Kong comparisons and things are very worthwhile in trying to think about how we in Melbourne, who love our city but struggle to make it work properly, need to progress in the future. The session that we're in, which is Climate Change in Australia, Trauma or Transformation, will continue tomorrow with more speakers and talkers and more debate, and I encourage you all to go to that. But in the meantime, thanks very much, Tom. Greatly appreciate it.